This is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Canary. Thanks for joining us. Anyone who was in Southwest Florida during 2018 was aware of the fact that Lake Okeechobee, the Caloosahatchee River and its estuary, and canals along the river, especially in Cape Coral, were choked by a massive blue-green algae bloom. It caused massive environmental damage and economic damage, but it also produced toxins that can be harmful to human health. Toward the end of that bloom, Florida Gulf Coast University marine science professor Dr. Mike Parsons conducted a pilot study collecting data on how far the toxins produced by the algae could travel through the air and how deeply they could make it into human lungs. Initial results showed the toxins could travel for miles and do make it all the way to the part of the lungs where air blood exchange occurs. Now, thanks to a grant from the Florida Department of Health, Dr. Parsons and his team are collecting more data using specialized air sampling devices placed in Cape Coral. WGCU's Julie Glenn sat down with Dr. Parsons, who's also director of FGCU's Vester Field Station and a member of Florida's Blue-Green Algae Task Force, to get the latest on that research and plans going forward. Let's listen to that now.
So just last week, you were out there putting out some air sampling apparatus?
Yes,
so
in Cape Coral.
Is this different from the air sampling that you did before?
No, we're actually even using some of the same air samplers that we used last time, and both ourselves, FGCU, and Cape Coral Public Works, their environmental lab, have purchased new air samplers. So we have more of them to put out now.
So remind me of the results from the last time around.
So the two biggest results from we had two deployments before, two time periods. One deployment we did in October of 2018. And it was right as the big cyanobacteria, big blue-green algal bloom in Cape Coral was starting to wind down. It was still there, but it was past the peak. And so we put out the air samplers at a residence in Cape Coral, right at the end of a canal. And we put a second air sampler at our Vester Field Station, which is down in Bonita Springs. And we let them run for about a month. And the air samplers basically just suck air the whole time. And then they have these different levels or these different stages. And so the first stage collects the biggest particles. And then by the time you get to the seventh stage, it collects the smallest particles. And that basically mimics our respiratory system. So the biggest particles get stuck in your nostrils and then in the back of your throat. And then the smallest particles work their way all the way down to your alveoli, your air sacs.
And that's where the exchange of air to blood kind of happens, right?
Yeah. So if breathing was going to lead to a toxin of transfer from the air into our bloodstream, the most likely place for that would be the air sacs, because that's where that process takes place.
Mm-hmm.
So we put these air samplers out, and we did detect toxins on all of the stages, including those smallest stages in stage seven, where basically we demonstrated that the microcystin toxins are associating with particles that are small enough to get into your alveoli. And so that was a pretty big finding.
Were you surprised?
In that sense. I was surprised, and it was more concerning when I heard that. But then the puzzling part was it also showed up in the Vester air samplers. And we measured the same amounts of toxins in Cape Coral and at Vester.
Which is how many miles away?
It's about 15 miles or so.
Mm-hmm.
And,
it doesn't mean necessarily.
As the crow flies, yeah.
I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean, though, that that particular one that ended up in the filter down at Vester came from all the way up in Cape Coral. But the bloom was happening up at the Caloosahatchee more so.
Yeah, so exactly. So it basically gave us two scenarios. Either number one – well, three scenarios, I guess. Number one, there was another bloom nearby that we didn't
Maybe
know
Imperial
about.
Maybe Imperial River or something?
Yeah, which – we have no evidence of,
yeah.
And nobody reported anything. Number two, we just measured background levels. The levels were 1 nanogram per cubic meter. I don't know if that's a lot or a little. That's how much it was.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's a little. And so we were measuring background levels. Or number three, it was from Cape Coral. And now all of a sudden the area of exposure is at least a 15-mile radius then. And so, you know, you basically have a big 30-mile circle around Cape Coral
where
that
the bloom's
could
at.
Be
yeah.
exposed.
And
then
scary.
Also, you know, you could expand that to on the Caloosahatchee, so on and so forth. So we're hoping it's not the third scenario. We're hoping it's just background levels.
So continuing this kind of sampling, air sampling, are you looking at trend data and when you have a lot, when you have a little, and how that correlates with the actual visible bloom that we know about?
So we did a follow-up study in over Christmas break in 2018 to 2019, and we did this up at the Buckingham campus that's up near Alva. And basically it's 3 miles away from the river, at least a mile away from any little pond that we knew of or anything like that. And we still detected toxins, but it was three times lower. And so then, you know, that brought up the same scenario that, okay, well, maybe it's background levels, but it was lower. But we still couldn't get zero. So what does that mean? And that was when our funding basically dried up for that pilot study. So it's taken this long to get the funding set up and get everything coordinated. And we're actually jumping the gun a little bit on the project. The money's not here yet at FGCU. It's still working its way through mm-hmm. through the system. But we put out the air samplers last week. And then on Valentine's Day, we'll be sampling volunteers. So it'll be Adam Schaefer, who's with the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute. He's an epidemiologist. So he'll be doing nasal swabs, urine samples.
That is so romantic on Valentine's Day. Yeah.
nothing so it's like, will you be my test subject?
Nothing says love like a nasal swab. but so this is we're going to be correlating the movement of things into the lungs and then the toxicity as it presents in a human with the swabs.
Right. So basically what we have is we'll have the air samplers we set up at four locations in Cape Coral, just basically around the Cape. And so just getting a general sense of what's in the air.
Now the Cape, because of all the canals and the possibility for collection of this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And then and two sites are actually closer to the coast. Mm-hmm. And the idea there is maybe if it's in the Coosahatchee or if it works its way farther downstream. And also we have an opportunity to sample for brevetoxin, which is associated with red tide. And we know brevetoxin can get airborne and aerosolize. And so the idea here
would that does not feel good.
It does not, definitely.
That is pepper spray.
And so the idea here is can we detect both toxins at the same time? And if people were being exposed to both, would it be worse than one versus the other? Do they have any synergistic effects?
Do they compound one another? Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
That's a good question. So, yeah, you mentioned the money. The state gave $650,000 to four Florida universities to look at the impact of these harmful algal blooms on public health. And so this is kind of a synergistic thing where you're working with other universities doing the swabs that we mentioned. Do we know yet what level of exposure is needed in order to have something present in a swab?
No.
We don't know. Is that what we're trying to determine with
this? That's what we're trying to determine. Yeah. So there have been other groups that have started collecting some data on it. I have not seen any of the data published yet. So I think everyone's still kind of in that developmental stage.
Wanting to make extra sure before they put it out there.
And just not enough data points.
Yeah.
You know, like our little study that we did has drawn a lot of interest, not just with the public, but with the scientific community as well. And, you know, usually when you get that level of interest, it's like, wow, we should publish this, you know. And I've given, you know, just a white paper or whatnot, unpublished paper on. I said, man, you know, this could be published, but it's an N of two, you know, so it doesn't really.
Is it what?
N of two. So you have two sampling points, you know, so it's like, well, you know, so that's
so
why you just need
more
data. We're getting more now, yeah.
Well, we're going to get more. So that's what we just set up. Has anything shown up in any of these filters that surprised you? That like just some – what is that? I mean, have you had any of those moments?
No, because all we did was look for the microcystins.
Okay.
And then we also did some secondary analyses on BMAA, which is another toxin, a neurotoxin that's also of great concern. But it's a little bit trickier in terms of detecting and quantifying. And so the way we're doing the analyses, we have to be very cautious because the data – you can get false positives pretty easily. And so, you know, we've detected it using one method. If you really want to be thorough, you need a couple different methods to do it. And we're just not there with that because we're actually looking from a detection point of view, we're looking at very low levels. So mm-hmm. it's when the things are in low levels are just harder to work with and harder to detect.
So how long are they going to be out there in Cape Coral right now?
we're going to leave them out for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So the first deployment, we left for a month. The ones we did up in Buckingham were 3 weeks. So now we're down to 2 weeks. Just getting more comfortable on what our limits of detection are. And we'll see, you know. And also it kind of brings in line, you know, what are people being exposed to? And, you know, when you leave it out there and just the pump turned on, it's basically collecting everything. But it – you end up averaging that over the period of deployment. So this is going to be kind of, you know, a 2 week average of what's in the air, you know, and maybe it was just one day somebody or one of the pumps just picked up, you know, a high level.
Or somebody turned on their boat in the middle of a pile of blue-green algae
and that could have put everything in the pump maybe in an hour, but we're running her for 2 weeks. So we're not going to see that pulse. We're instead going to see it just kind of smeared out over that two weeks.
Smeared out.
So we're just learning how to do more strategic deployments and, you know, get a better sense of what the data are telling us and how we can more strategically deploy to answer some of the questions that might be coming up in the future.
I heard a little bit about some blue-green algae a few weeks ago. It seems like 3 weeks ago, maybe four weeks ago. It's still around? Is it still there now?
It's always around.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of what's blooming and where. And so, and then there was also that dinoflagellate, the Akashiwo sanguineum that was
easy
blooming.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah. And that was blooming, I think, before Christmas, and it's out blooming now again or still.
Is that the one that's not so toxic?
Right.
Okay, yeah. That one's just kind of there and just ugly.
It discolors the water and it can draw down oxygen levels, which can kill fish.
That's not good.
And it actually makes like a mucus too, and so that can clog up fish gills and things. So it's more of a nuisance algae rather than a toxic one.
But. Yeah. Is that new to us?
No.
Oh, okay. We just hadn't heard of it before.
It's been blooming in the region before, but I think everyone's just a little more sensitive and aware.
Any kind of bloom of anything.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not a flower.
Right.
So the partnership with Florida Atlantic University is about the human body, how it's impacting the human body. That's where the swabbing is going through?
Yeah. So basically on the FGCU side of it, it's air sampling and some water samples along with it. And then the Harbor Branch side of it is the human testing. Yeah. And so basically the approach that Adam is taking with this is they have a flyer and it has to get approved by their it's called an IRB board, which is when you're dealing with human subjects and things like that. So you make a flyer, you have date and time where you're going to do it, and then you put out the flyers and give them to people to distribute, and then you wait and see who shows up at the door. So,
yeah. I'm wondering if there's other ways that people can be getting this into their system too. And I'm thinking about like epidermis, going through people's skin. Like even an airborne landing on skin, is it possible to go through that?
It's possible, but it as far as I know, and I haven't seen any data on that being a real vector of concern.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our skin is a really good barrier.
Yeah.
And so for a toxin to get into the skin or on the skin and then through the skin and into the bloodstream, you know, you're basically going through, you know, fat, water, skin.
Mm-hmm.
And molecules don't like to go between – it's like oil and water.
Okay.
They don't like to go between the two of those too much, and that's a pretty effective barrier.
Yeah, the only reason I ask about that is because I've done a lot of things talking with firefighters and talking about the toxicity of the smoke that they go in. Of course, these are burning chemical particles. They're not blue-green algae, so it's a different situation. That's the only reason I ask about that because they say that cleaning off the skin is critical for firefighters leaving the scene of –
And there are chemicals that can get that can soak into the skin.
More so than an algae.
Well, more so than microcystin
in
particular.
Okay.
And there are other compounds and other toxins that are produced by various blue-green algae that are skin irritants, and we call those dermotoxins. And so they basically, you know, people can swim in the water and get a rash and so on and so forth. But that rash doesn't lead to, you know, soaking into the bloodstream and then the person having some serious health issues.
So you're doing this for a couple of weeks and then bring them in, test everything. Are you going to be putting them back out? Or are you going to do this in kind of a continuous rotation or in different places or anything?
So when the Florida legislature appropriated these funds for the study, by the time the Department of Health you know, got their budgets all squared away and came up with their plan on how they wanted to conduct these studies and then put out the request for proposals and then people had time to write them, and then they reviewed them, and then they dispersed the funds. We're already halfway through the fiscal year.
Yeah.
So the idea is, we want to have the studies finished by the end of June, and then hopefully earlier, so the Department of Health, right now one reason why we're hitting the ground running with this is so we can show the Department of Health, hey, we're doing these studies, look, and then they can go back to the legislature and say, see, this money's already being used. We're starting to get data coming in.
Proof of performance.
Yeah. So year one, we're basically making sure we hit dry season now, mm-hmm. and then wet season, May or June. And with these blue-green algal blooms, they like the warmer temperatures. They like it when you get new nutrients coming in with runoff and things like that. So hopefully we won't have a big bloom this year. But in either case, if we have one or not, May and June we're going to be sampling to make sure we get our wet season data point in this year one. And then we'll see if there's continued funding for year two and beyond, where we can maybe do a more of an elaborate study, or at least continue and get some more of these data points so we know what is high and what is low and things like that.
I feel like interest in this subject has not waned as much as I had originally anticipated. I figured the minute that the crisis was over, people would stop caring, but it seems like they haven't.
No. There's still a lot of interest, and I think, the fact that this past year there was blue-green algal blooms around, and, we had some on the lakes, and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers did a great job of managing their flow schedule, so we didn't have those blooms being released downstream. But I think people were more breathing a sigh of relief rather than, see, that was an anomaly. That was just a once-in-a-lifetime thing. So we're like, well, I'm glad that didn't happen again, this year.
Yeah, it seems like a different take on it,
Yeah.
And it's interesting how you mentioned the Army Corps of Engineers, that their management of the lake seems to have been altered.
This past year they used flexible scheduling. And so that just gave them a little leeway in terms of how to manage the lake levels and when to do their discharges. It wasn't strictly by the book. It was flexible. And my understanding is right now they're currently in discussions with other stakeholders on making the new schedules for the releases. How low can you let the lake go? How high can it go before you have to do discharges or stop?
Mm-hmm.
And so it'll be interesting to see what these new revisions are based on the old schedules, because we know what happened with the old schedules. We didn't get enough fresh water during dry season. Our tape grass would die and it would cause stress on other organisms. And during wet season, just open up the gates and just too much water.
Let it fly, yeah.
So instead of trying to, keep it more even over the course of a year, it was too little, too much.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we'll see if that can be improved upon.
It's quite the balancing act, though.
It is. And
there's
a tough job.
And there's a lot dependent on that.
Yeah. And there's it's not simply a human safety concern. It's how water is allocated to different uses for agriculture, for municipal needs, and the needs of the estuary, so on and so forth. So there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of interest. But on the other hand, it's with these various reservoirs that are coming online and in the planning stages, we'll be able to store more water. And that should, help relieve some of the pressures on the flows going east and west. And then, of course, eventually get a lot of this or most of this water moving south back into the Everglades. And then hopefully see continued restoration for South Florida.
Yeah. If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Dr. Mike Parsons. He is professor of marine science at Florida Gulf Coast University and director of FGCU's Vester Field Station. He's also a member of Florida's Blue-Green Algae Task Force. We're getting an update on his ongoing research into toxins produced by cyanobacteria. To add your thoughts, please find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So the Blue-Green Algae Task Force passed along its recommendations last year. Has that task force still been meeting?
We haven't met since October,
mm-hmm.
and we were going to meet January 23rd, but we postponed that meeting. So now we're going to be meeting early to mid-March,
mm-hmm.
and part of the postponement was because of these blue-green algal issues, and Tom Frazier, the chief science officer for Florida, wanted to get a better sense of what the status was in terms of the work being done with blue-green algae and the assessments of its human health impact, so on and so forth. And so now that a lot of these projects are underway and, you know, the CDC is hoping to Center for Disease Control is hoping to coordinate efforts and be able to leverage some resources, and maybe we can pool some of our volunteers and our cohorts and things like that. So we do have a plan moving forward, and, you know, there's going to need some there will be some need for refinement and, you know, definitely a lot of communication among the different universities working on it, state mm-hmm. and federal agencies as well.
So the recommendations' key ingredients were what? Can you remind me?
So basically, if you look at the overall recommendations that the task force provided, they ranged from anything to doing septic tank inspections, for the basin management action plans, getting a better sense of field data to basically back up what the numbers were saying in the models and things like that, look at projects that would give the biggest bang for the buck. For the best management practices with agricultural producers, we recommended that some empirical data, field data, be collected so then we can see if the best management practices are resulting in nutrient reductions or the anticipated nutrient reductions.
Or if they're actually the best.
Well, that, I mean, yeah. They may be the best for farming, but there may not be the best. I mean, the best management practice for reducing nutrients on a farm, on a field, is don't use fertilizer. But that's not going to happen. We need to, you know, fertilize to get the production. And
it'd be interesting to get the Ag Extension Services involved in that too, as far as like, here's the threshold of this is good. But no farmer wants to spend extra money on fertilizer and just have it run off.
Right, exactly. You know?
That's not smart either. So the Florida legislature is meeting now. Have you seen any bills that are interesting to you? Or do you even follow that, or you just kind of look at the ones that are kind of tagged for water?
Well, the big one has that most of the attention has been on is Senate Bill 712. Mm-hmm. And so that incorporates a lot of the task force recommendations. And so it'll be interesting to see how our recommendations translate into legislative action, really, mm-hmm. on that. And, you know, so there are some hiccups. So, for example, or complications, I should say, when we talk about best management practices with agricultural producers, there have been discussions on, well, how often should samples and data be collected? And, you know, from a scientific point of view, you know, every week, every month, you know, and
as much as possible.
As much as possible, so we can really get a sense of what kind of inputs there are, so on and so forth. But from an agricultural producer point of view, or even if we talk about Department of Environmental Protection or Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, there's over 10,000 agricultural producers. So how are you going to collect all those samples?
That's not free.
You know, that's not free.
That's going to cost some money.
And the bodies even. And so
yeah.
It's like, all right, well, what's manageable?
Yeah.
And so there's discussions on, you know, well, we can't do it every week. Not that that was on the table, you know, but it's like, what can we really do realistically given, you know,
yeah.
the constraints of resources.
But looping in the idealistic too for the scientists in the room,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And so it's like, well, you know, if you collect one data point for 10 years, just one, that's not going to represent anything.
No,
you know,
yep.
So you have too little on one hand, and you know, I don't know if you can have too much data, but you act on the best available data.
Well, who are you kidding? So. You know, you can never have too much data. I'm just kidding. Yeah. Well, we'll be keeping an eye on that legislation as it moves through. Dr. Parsons, thanks for your time as always.
All right, thank you.
That was Julie Glenn speaking with Dr. Mike Parsons, professor of marine science at Florida Gulf Coast University and director of FGCU's Vester Field Station and a member of Florida's Blue-Green Algae Task Force. If you missed any of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by Julie Glenn and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Life is made possible through the generous generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Kinirey. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM NPR for Southwest Florida.